Okay, while we are getting started on this, welcome to the seminar. Let me introduce our speaker today, Paul Harrison. Professor Paul Harrison worked on the WS78 beauty production experiment for his PhD at UCL and on the CP Lear neutral kaolin experiment as a postdoctoral research assistant at Liverpool. As an academic at Queen Mary University of London, he worked on PIPA and became the first physics coordinator in 1993. He also worked in flavor phenomenology, writing a number of highly cited papers, particularly on the tonic mixing with Don Perkins and Bill Scott. He moved to Warwick in 2004 to found the Experimental Particle Physics Group and later joined the ATLAS experiment, where he currently works on the CKM measurements using on-shell W decays on top pair events. In today's seminar, he will review his latest publication in phenomenology. Welcome.
Thank you. Okay, so the outline of my talk, the first two sections, first three sections are completely standard, and I'll always quickly through them. But I do want to just remind of the mysteries of the quark and quark mass and mixing spectra, and some of the, just a very brief mention of actually just one or two historical efforts to explain them. And then the mysteries of the unitary triangle, and then the new mass matrix spectra. This work was done with Bill Scott, and it's published. It came out early last year in JHEP. Bill Scott, who of this lab, retired, but he's still active. We're still collaborating on various bits and pieces. He apologised he couldn't be here today. His wife's sick. Then I'll talk about confronting the mass matrix texture with the data, and then talk about the symmetries of the texture, which to some extent are the most interesting part, but that's right at the end, and then a quick discussion. Okay, so the mystery with quark mass spectra is, of course, that on a log scale, the quark masses appear to be approximately to form straight lines for the charged two-thirds quarks. Charged two-thirds quarks in this talk are always red, and charged minus a third quarks are always blue. And the slope of the red one is steeper than the slope of the blue one. And actually, the graph somehow makes them look straighter than they are, because the MC over MT is about 0.035, MU over MC is 0.02, and MS over MB is 0.02, and MB over MS is 0.05. But they're approximately kind of exponentially going with generation. This, of course, is nothing new. I'm just reminding us, and it's been noted by many authors. The masses are not predicted in the standard model there. They come from the Higgs mechanism. They come from the coupling of the Higgs to the quarks, and they're free parameters in the standard model. This hierarchy, as it's called, this exponential increase in mass with family or generation is certainly not explained within the standard model, and I'm not going to explain it. At least not today, anyway. There's a mechanism beyond the standard model, the Frog and Nielsen mechanism, which works quite well to explain this. And there are lots of brain-inspired models and things which have some success in explaining these kinds of things. I'm not going to be talking about those either. So then on to the mystery of the quark mixing spectrum. As we know, the CK matrix couples the charged two-thirds quarks to charged minus a third quarks. And it's hierarchical in the sense that expanding in the small parameter lambda, the sine of the Kibibo angle, this one here, which we just measured at ATLAS, is proportional roughly to lambda points of order lambda squared, and this small one, the VUB, is of order lambda cubed. And so this hierarchical structure also isn't explained in the standard model at all. So we've said that. But the masses unexplained and the mixings that both have these strong hierarchies. They both arise in the same place in the standard model, the Yukawa, or the, or also called just the mass matrices, in the Yukawa cappings, essentially. And so it's tempting to think that these hierarchies might have a common, the reason for them might be common to the two, might be common, coming from the essentially the Yukawa cappings of the Higgs to the quarks. So very quickly, the weak interaction. In the gauge theory, we're dealing with gauge eigenstates, not mass eigenstates, and so we can just label them 1, 2, 3 for the families. And we have a universal coupling. So the CKM matrix is the identity, essentially, in this basis. And so we can put this in a sort of matrix notation here, that the weak Lagrangian is given by the weak coupling, and then the W is coupled to the simple dot between the ups and the downs, with no matrix in between them apart from the identity implicitly there. So the masses and mixings arise, as I've already mentioned, in the couplings of the Higgs to pairs of quarks of the same charge. And so for quark generations, well, 1 and 2, we call that Yukawa with a subscript 1, 2. Remembering that these numbered ones are the gauge eigenstates. And after spontaneous symmetry breaking, the Higgs can be decomposed into the constant BEV and the physical Higgs. And so the diagram splits, you get the bit where phi is V over root 2, just gives you a V over root 2, Y 1, 2, and that's the mass term, which somehow couples the one and the one left and the two right, which may or may not be the same. Then the residual, the physical Higgs also couples it. So this is how the masses are proportioned to the Higgs couplings to the physical quarks. Taking all permutations, you have a 3x3 matrix for charge plus 2/3 quarks, and you have another 3x3 matrix for charge minus 1/3 quarks, and they just get added in the Lagrangian. This is after SSB. And the mass matrices are just V over root 2 times the respective Yukawa matrices, and the important thing is these Yukawa matrices are not diagonal. So it is possible to choose a basis now where they're Hermitian without observable consequences, and that's what we'll do. Essentially, free rotations in the right-handed quark fields, free redefinition of the basis on the right-hand fields, because they don't couple in the weak interaction. So you can always make these Hermitian. The physical particles, of course, are the mass eigenstates, as standard in particle physics. So usual unitary rotation, a different one for the ups than for the downs. And then we get the mass and the weak interaction Lagrangian can be written as a diagonal mass matrix for the U's, a diagonal mass matrix for the D's. And the U mass eigenstate and the D mass eigenstate get coupled by a product of two unitary matrices. So that's just the diagonalized mass matrices, and this is the Secant matrix. Always nice to remember it's actually a product of two diagonalizing matrices. So this is the story of how the mass eigenvalues and the physical quark mixings both originate from the original Yukawa matrices. So they have a common origin. So how can we relate the mass ratios and the mixing parameters, the mixing angles? One way is by enforcing something called texture zeros, an idea by Harold Fritsch from the 1970s, which has been immensely successful. There's thousands and thousands of phenomenology papers doing this kind of thing. They're nearly excluded now because the measurements of quark masses and mixing are so precise that it's difficult to find a model that still fits the data. And that's kind of what we've done, if you like. So the Fritsch, I should be using the pointer more, I guess. There we go. The Fritsch matrix here has this form with these texture zeros, and those are enforced by various symmetries that you can just sort of choose, which force these things to be zero. So the mass of the down-like matrix, the 3x3 undiagonalized mass matrix here, proportional to the Yukawa couplings, is given by a normalization close to the B mass, and then this thing with these zeros and these parameters A, D, and B, D. They can be complex, which introduces CP violation. And we find once you diagonalize and solve for masses, you can invert and find that A, D is a simple function of the mass ratios, and it, as is BD, and they have these actual values. This is diagonalized by the unitary matrix on the charge minus a third quarks, and it's got a sine of an angle, a sine of another angle here, and the product of the two sines. So if these angles are quite small, this will be extra small, and that's kind of looking a bit like the Secant matrix. So this looks like it might work, and of course this is why this was a successful model. And we've got S1 is given in terms of A and B, so it's just given by this square root formula, and is about 0.22, which is already very close to the Kvigo angle. And for this one here, the 2-3 element, if you like, that's smaller, but not a great deal smaller. It's the square root of ms over nb. So it's encouraging, to say the least. What does Fritsch predict for VUS itself? S2 and S3 were a bit too big, especially S2 and S3, actually. And what we haven't done is treated mu yet. So we want to treat mu symmetrically. Sorry, this is an interesting changer here. So we use the same form, the Fritsch matrix of three new parameters in red to remind us that we're dealing with the two-thirds quarks. And the CKM matrix then is this product of unitary diagonalizing matrices. Remembering that the dagger is like an inverse, so it's like a rotation and a rotation back. So this is good for generating small mixing angles. You know, what's not to like there? So in the complex case, you get a phase that then becomes observable, and it gives CP violation. And together we get the prediction for VUS. This is the Fritsch prediction of S, the sine of theta one, and then the sine of theta one for the ups with times the exponential of the waves. And subbing in the mass ratios and everything, you get this plot here. So you can, this is the experimental value of the sine of the Kvigo angle, 0.222 roughly. And here you've got the sinusoidal variation from the modulus of this complex number, essentially. And where they meet is where we're agreeing with the data. And you can read off this delta tilde parameter, and that will tell you something about CP violation. How about the predictions for the CB and the UB? Here, a second phase enters. This is the difference in the phases of the Bs. As in all these kinds of models, the absolute phases are unobservable, but relative phases are observable. And one finds a similar formula with the second signs of the theta twos, if you like. And again, there's a sinusoidal variation. And this is the prediction, you know, which doesn't look too bad. And it gets you from the 0.14 we had before down to 0.07 roughly. But the experiment is very clear that it's 0.04, very close to 0.04. The width of the band here is given by doing this fit either at something like the weak scale, just above the weak scale, or at a gut type scale. And it doesn't help very much. So these are too big. This angle is too big. And so Fritsch is now excluded. But it's got many features which are very attractive, which are worth preserving. That's the point. Also, the ratio of VUB over VCB, that's the smallest one times the, divided by the second smallest one, is predicted also to be lambda, which is unfortunately too small.
Well, can I ask a question? I don't know if you want to be interrupted or not.
No, I don't mind.
Because I think you sort of finished the Fritsch.
I've finished the fifth, yeah, and it's excluded, yeah.
So the philosophy of it, or the, is that it's a kind of mathematical trick where you make a prediction, and if it had agreed with the one data point we have, which is the inverse that we seem to have, what the ratios are,
Yeah.
then that tells you something about what the underlying dynamics
Yeah, you
were.
might say if it had fitted the data really well, especially with now the data very, you know, very accurately measured in many cases, then you would say this looks like maybe right.
And where does that get you? Do you see what I mean? Should we think of it as a trick of the mathematics that it seems to be right, or does it then does it relate to some sort of broader interpretation then of what's really going on?
So there are many models in which which type zeros are natural. So they have additional discrete symmetries and things, and those just they constrain those zeros either
Okay.
exactly or approximately. And so you might think those models which do that in a natural looking way might be failing.
I see. Okay, thank you.
So you're using it as a signpost to say this small collection of models, which predict this kind of thing are
Oh,
likely to be
natural.
right.
Yes,
But
okay.
one of them might be right. But there's of course some variations in the sort of in the space of models.
Cool, thank you.
Okay. So what have we got here? I'm just trying to remember which button is which. Yeah, okay. So yeah, I'm a bit puzzled. I think this must be square because this prediction is 0.04. Anyway, it doesn't agree, as we've already said. I've taken these plots from this nice paper. These people have, but what they've tried to do is a recent to get to find out, they're looking for a way to make Fritsch agree, having been excluded about 20 years ago. And their approach was to use non-Hermitian mass matrices by some game which I must didn't fully understand. But because they're non-Hermitian, they have more parameters. It's got 10 parameters, which is the same number of parameters you're hoping to fit. And they still can't fit the data. So ultimately, their approach is also excluded as far as I can tell. Anyway, so that's the end of the first half of the talk, which is the sort of the theoretical framework, if you like, and the historical attempts to explain this kind of thing. And we employ some of Fritsch's stuff, but not all of it. I want to talk before I go on about the unitarity triangle itself, because some of the proofs we do have got very nice geometric justifications or geometric proofs, which help understand rather than just a bunch of algebra. And it's nice for a talk. So, of course, the secant matrix is unitary. If you dot any pair of rows and columns, therefore, you get zero, a complex dot product. And this is the sum of three complex numbers, which makes a triangle in a complex plane, and its area is proportional to CP violation. It's the phase convention, an independent measure of CP violation, as famously discovered by Yalzov. You can either take the one that's exactly given by this, or you can divide through by one of these product, the mod of one of these products, and get a base of unity. And there's six different triangles. You can dot three rows in three different ways. You can dot three columns in three different ways. All triangles are different shapes, and they all have the same area. That's a beautiful result of Yalzbrog. And with the normalized one, it's just proportional half eta bar, where eta bar is the complex space or the complex parameter in the secant matrix. So it's clearly CP violated. If you want to shrink the triangle to zero, you get rid of CP violation, and secant matrix becomes real. So, what are the mystery? There are new mysteries which I haven't mentioned yet. The mysteries of the unitarity triangle. So, it's been long realized. I spent many years of my career measuring alpha and beta at Barbar, and we measured beta first, and it turned out to be close to 25 degrees or something, and then we measured alpha, and it's about 90 degrees. In fact, it's consistent with being exactly 90 degrees. And that's been noted by many authors, and some people built it into models. And beta, and it was actually Tim Gershon, who donkeys years ago pointed out, said, beta's compatible with pi by eight. Now, this is neurology, of course. But when you start to see a lot of numerical coincidence, you can ask, well, is there some physics behind that, or is it just an accident? So I took Tim's offhand remark quite to heart, and I thought about it for about 50 years before this came out. But anyway, so the angles, of course, once you've got two of them, they sum to 180 degrees. So you've got the third one, this is 3 pi by 8 or something, and they're consistent with what we call these three special values. So it seems striking. Is it a coincidence, or is it a smoking gun of some physics behind this? So Bill and I decided to try and cook up a scheme which incorporates this in a natural way. And would this be a clue to what's lying behind these measurements? So this is the Harrison-Scott texture from our recent paper. And both mass matrices should have this form, and I'll take you through it carefully. It's normalized to one in the biggest element here in the corner. And it's got four real parameters, the green ones. And the Q here is either up or down for two-thirds or minus a third. So taken, these green ones are the same for the ups and the downs. The lambdas are different for ups and downs. That's why they're purple, because they're halfway between red and blue, if you like. So Q is up and down. The lambda Q is a complex parameter. It looks a bit like the Wolfenstein parameter, but it's complex. The argument of Q is unobservable, but the relative phase between the Q up and Q down is observable. In fact, the ratio of lambda U over lambda D is observable, and it's a complex number because they're complex. But in our approach, this is asserted to be minus I tan by tan pi by A, which looks a bit random. This minus I is a phase of 90 degrees, and that's going to correspond to alpha, at least in leading approximation. And this corresponds to the tangent of beta, quite amazingly, once you diagonalize this matrix. So this lambda, this minus I is the sole source of CP violation in this texture. And as you can imagine, it's sort of maximal CP violation, modulo all the other constraints. That's sort of good because the unitary triangle is kind of is the area as big as it can be when one of the angles is 90 degrees. I think you'll find it probably is. So this, as I've already alluded to, controls the this ratio controls this real and imaginary parts control the ratio control two of the angles of the unitary triangle. There are only two free angles. So I've said all this. And the complex sum, lambda U plus lambda D, is a parameter to be fitted, and it turns out to be very close to Wolfenstein's lambda. So that's also neat. You know, it's taking the role of Wolfenstein, if you like. Well, except that it's a mass matrix and not a mixing matrix, but there's a close mapping between them. And it describes 10 observables with 7 real parameters. Fritsch had 5 real parameters. So we're not as predictive as Fritsch, but on the other hand, we're not excluded. So that's good. So the leading order solution, if you diagonalize, you just get a formula for the mass matrix, the diagonal mass matrix in terms of some of the parameters. And it's hierarchical. As long as lambda is small, it's hierarchical. We're not explaining why lambda is small here, but we're using the fact that it's small to get the hierarchy here. I talk about leading orders because you can solve these things with small rotations, and then you can ignore products of small rotations, and you're a leading order. Or you can take everything into account, just well, do the whole diagonalization numerically, then you've got this higher order calculation. So there are three parameters to fit four mass ratios. So there's one constraint, and it's a constraint on the double mass ratio, which should be exactly equal to mod lambda U lambda D squared, which is tan squared pi by 8, which is 0.172. And if you do the full calculation numerically, you get 0.176. And the experimental value, mass ratios are now known to very high precision, courtesy of lattice QCD and fitting to the data, of course, and compared to 1.177 plus 9.002. So it's a rather good fit. And there's enough parameters here to fit any MD or MD separately, so there's no prediction there. The quark mixing, one of the either of the diagonalizing matrices takes this form where I think the plus is for Q up and the minus is for Q down. And it looks a bit of the same form exactly as the Wolfenstein parameterization. So that's nice mathematically. And when you take the UU times the dagger of UB, you get differences. But because of the signs, the differences become sums. And you'll remember I told you that lambda zero is lambda U plus lambda D. So that comes from here. And essentially, at leading order, you know, you just sum that angle and sum that angle, and you get this. It's a bit more complicated in the corners. But you get, so this is This is the actual prediction for the CKM matrix, or the calculation of the CKM matrix, and it's very Wolfenstein-like, with one lambda, two lambdas, and three lambdas, and an A. And of course, it's reverse engineered. It's built to work like this, because a lot of the formulae you can just read off by inspection, even though you're diagonalizing three by three matrices, which is a bit of a handful normally. So there you go. So this also allows you, for example, to read off that lambda times rho minus I eta better be lambda u. And the other one, which isn't independent, lambda times 1 minus rho minus I eta better be lambda d star. So you read off lambda is lambda 0, a is a 0, hence the notation. And rho plus I eta is the scaled value of lambda u star. What about the unitarity triangles? I've already told you the answer. Now, this kind of essentially proves it. This is the normalized unitarity triangle, V u b star over a lambda q, VTB over a lambda q. And the blue one is lambda d star, and the red one is lambda u star. So the lambdas, in fact, turn out to be the size of the unitarity triangle, the lambdas that we have to pick in the mass matrices at the beginning, scaled by 1 power of lambda. And gamma over here is the argument of lambda u star. Beta is the argument of lambda c, and alpha, that's in a particular phase dimension, and alpha is the argument of the ratio up to a minus sign. So at leading order, we've got alpha is pi by 2, tan beta is tan pi by 8. Sorry, I've gone zooming ahead by mistake. Tan beta, if once this is a right angle, tan beta is obviously that divided by that, which is just lambda u over lambda d. Okay, So those predictions are at leading order. The higher order corrections in rotations and things give very small, or, well, modest adjustments, and that actually helps the fit in the end. So what is the fit? We do a precision fit to the data. We've got our 7 parameters. We've got this 10 inputs. We put them in. It's all done in Mathematica program. Data, latest PDG with some lattice input as well. We renormalize the Collins scale of mass at the top, the weak scale to start with. And we fit using full numerical diagonalization rather than any approximations. And we get a terrible fit. So give up. It's all rubbish. Even though the maths was pretty, 100 over 3, we got 3 degrees of freedom, 7 parameters for 10 observables. There's tension between A, mass charm over mass top, and mass strange over mass beauty. There's a disaster, or is it? Because it's exactly these three quantities which run with renormalization scale. Okay, so people get surprised when I tell them that the CKM matrix runs with the renormalization scale, but it does. They're coupling constants. The Yukawas are coupling constants. They run like all other coupling constants. It turns out that the Kabibwo angle hardly runs at all. It's very, very, very slow running. But A, which is essentially controls VCB, runs by about 13% from the weak to gut scale. And these two ratios also run actually by this essentially the same factor. These two get bigger as you go from the weak to the gut scale, and this gets smaller by about 13%. While all the other parameters, lambda itself, the Kabibwo angle, alpha, beta, the angle, the shape of the unitarity triangle is not exactly precisely invariant, but to 5 decimal places is invariant under evolution in the standard model. And these mass ratios are essentially invariant. So this suggests to see if we very knew the scale at which you're doing all this fit might help the fit. I'm standing here because it does. We allow the renormalization scale that we use. So you have to, this involves evolving all the parameters between the weak scale and the gut scale and redoing the fit and making the scale variable and putting it in your program. And we get a fit of 1 over 2 degrees of freedom. We've lost the degree of freedom because we've added mu as a variable. The best fit is about 10 to the 40 V. The precision isn't fantastic because these things are varying logarithmically, so you don't get a great, like all these kinds of games, you don't get a great precision on the scale at which, so this would be the scale at which the textures are exact. The assumption is that there's some new physics, like these additional symmetries, discrete symmetries, which would force some of these special parameters to take those values. These are just the numbers for the record. This curve is, well, these curves, these are the contribution to chi-squared from A, from MC over MT, and MS over MB. And at the 10 to the 3, we were down here, which was responsible for the large chi-squared. In fact, 10 to the 2, I said the weak scale. This was our, 100, basically 100 for the total chi-squared. And as you go up in scale, they all, the fit gets better and better, and they all minimize at the same point, which is kind of lucky, I suppose, for us. 10 to the 4 TeV, if this and that, these te if these textures have anything to do with new physics, then they apply at 10 to the 4 TeV. That might be the scale of new physics. Just for the record, these are the inputs we normalized to 10 to the 4 TeV. These are the fitted values. So of course there are seven floating parameters in this plus the scale. The predictions for the unitarity triangles, rather than being exactly 90 degrees, they vary a little bit by higher order terms. And so you get 91.3 compared to 91.6, 22.3 divided by 10, compared to 22.6. Our predictions have got very small uncertainties. So experiments got a while to catch up, I suppose, but that's okay. And so these fitted values here are predictions. The bit. There are 2 degrees of freedom. Then we can just to look at this, the pictorial representation I advertised at the beginning, we're going to need to define these are the sides of the unitarity triangle, the Z0 and the Z0 bar. It's just notation. In fact, Z bar is 1 minus Z0 bar is 1 minus Z0. They're not independent. And the sines and cosines here are all sines and cosines of pi by 8, quarter of a right angle. And I call it the leading order unitarity triangle because, of course, this is the unitarity triangle at leading order in these small rotations. And Z0 and Z0 bar are just proxies for the normalized lambda u and lambda d. So the last section of the talk is the symmetries of the texture. So the symmetries are properties of the paired system mu and nd. So somehow the Yukawas here have to be coupled. There has to be a reason for the mu's and the nd's to have the same form as matrices, and for the parameters to be related to each other. So that's an unusual feature of this texture. And the symmetries I'm going to discuss could be viewed as consequences of these forms. Or preferably, you might want to view them as ab initio symmetries. So, like a gauge symmetry, you start off and say, well, we've got these fields in our model, these are the gauge symmetries, and the Lagrangian is already defined. So, the idea here is, and the interactions are defined, the idea here would be that the symmetries are defined, and that then defines the mass matrices. Obviously, it defines some constraints on the mass matrices. And the next slides outline what these symmetries are and how they look. So, in order to understand the pictorial representation of these symmetries, we just need a little bit of unitarity triangle technology. Under CP, all complex numbers in the mass matrices get complex conjugated. That's well known. And what that does to the unitarity triangle is it inverts it. So, eta bar becomes minus eta bar. That's just a complex conjugation of the whole CKM matrix. And of course, the triangle gets reflected in the real axis, and that's a CP violation. A rephasing of the parameters in the mass matrices can rephase rows and columns of the CKM matrix. What that does is it rotates the unitarity triangle. And again, the Alsgaard demonstrated that the observables of the unitary triangle are its area and the lengths of its sides. The orientation is completely unspecified. It's like a gauge transformation. You rotate the triangle unobservably. The physics is invariant. So there's a nice, well, I hope it's nice. This picture's from the paper. What is the symmetry that ensures that alpha is 90 degrees effectively? And it's a symmetry of the mass matrices in terms of these parameters we define, z0 and z0 bar, the sides of the standard unitary triangle. If you flip either z0 or z0 bar, give it a minus sign. So if you let z, I want to construct now a unitary triangle. Hang on, let's get this right. A unitary triangle from minus z0 bar and, sorry, minus z0 going down here and plus z0 bar. And this green one is the resultant. This triangle here is a rotated form of this green one. So it's a rotated form of the CP transformed unitary triangle. By negating one of the sides, in other words, one of the lambdas in the mass matrix, you flip the sign of CP violation and you rotate the triangle. But rotations are unobservable, so it's just a CP transformation. That's equivalent to CP transformation. There is no other. The other example is to use, plus z0 minus z0 bar, and you get this triangle, which also unsurprisingly rotates into this triangle. But it's only true when you've got 90 degrees at this angle. If this angle were anything other than 90 degrees, a simple sort of just think about it, flipping this from plus to minus will then leave an angle here that's not 180 degrees. And then this triangle isn't the same shape as this triangle. And you've done more than flip the sign of CP violation. You've changed the magnitude of CP violation. So you've changed the magnitudes of some of the ZKM sides. Okay, so the combination of a flip in sign of either of these parameters and the CP transformation is a symmetry if and only if alpha is 90 degrees. That's this. So take it the other way around. Alpha is fixed 90 degrees by imposing this symmetry on the mass matrices. Okay. So symmetry is good to all of them. Yeah, although the demonstration of this in the pictorial terms is done with the leading order unitary triangle. Surprisingly, if you do it algebraically, it's good to all orders. So what symmetry requires that the angle beta is a quarter of a right angle? If we start off by assuming that this beta angle is not pi by 8, so let it be pi by 8 plus a bit more, and then we try rotating through minus 90 degrees. It's absolutely obvious this becomes something down here, which is not a side of an angle of a triangle that's a reflection of that. But if the angle beta tilde, which is just the generalization of beta, is exactly pi by 8, then if you subtract pi by 4 from it, then that's equivalent to CP transformation. So it might, some people think this is more tenuous, but the symmetry is that if you subtract pi by 4 from beta and you get the CP transform triangle, then beta better be pi by 8. It's a special angle, pi by 4, okay? So that's the second symmetry. And in fact, the two symmetries taken together, if you flip the sign of one side and subtract pi by 4 from beta, you will get back to the beginning. That's the symmetry. That requires both angles to be 90 degrees and a quarter of 90 degrees. Okay, so that's the symmetry content of the mass matrices, which predict the CKM angles and the masses which fit the data with 7 free parameters. Okay, so to conclude, we've proposed a geometric hierarchical mass matrix texture. We don't explain the hierarchies. The idea was to try and explain these accidental or coincidental, perhaps, particular angles in the Unitardy Triangle using symmetries. The mass hierarchy and slopes are related. So this is interesting. The mass hierarchy, that's the slopes of the plots of the from the very first slide, the ones that show the mass hierarchy, the blue and the red lines, those slopes are related to the sizes, the lengths of the unitary triangle sides. The symmetries constrain the forms, two discrete symmetries constrain the forms, alpha to be approximately pi by 2, and beta to be approximately pi by 8, and exactly that at leading order. The hierarchy is not explained, but if we were to combine this by some model building with a Frog-Nielsen type mechanism, we could also potentially explain the hierarchies. I've said all this before. Seven parameters to fit 10 observables with a chi-squared of 1 for 2 degrees of freedom. There's a single precise prediction of the quark mass ratios, which fits the data spectacularly. And there are three predictions for the unitary triangles, two unitary triangle angles, two of which are independent. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a very beautiful talk.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, let's move on to the question. Yeah, timing is doing well. We have time for questions.
Thanks, Paul. That's very brilliant. So on page 20, where you have your little diagram of everything coinciding. Yeah, there we are. So you pointed there to a scale that's being pointed out there by everything coinciding. Can you relate that to any predictions in other contexts? If you just take that by itself and say, okay, this is the scale at which I expect new physics, can I then use that to make predictions in other contexts for things that we might be able to observe?
Okay, that's a good question. I mean, there are certainly, there's obviously lots of BSN models out there that try and explain lots of things that are otherwise unexplained in the standard model. And some of the neutrino models, which predict mixing matrices, electrons that are close to what we see, approximately tri by maximal, if you like. Some of those models have scales of new physics at around this scale. I mean, there are models with new physics occurring at all kinds of scales. Obviously, the gut scale is a very special scale for other reasons. But there are certainly, should we say, classes of models where the relevant scale is about 10 to 4 TeV. I've had messages from some of the geophysicists saying, oh, my model really uses exactly that scale. That's great. I mean, certainly what one could say is, it related to that, is what do we say about the leptons? And the answer is nothing at the moment. We haven't attempted to include the leptons in this scheme. Many years ago, we tried to do stuff with electrons, the tri by maximal mixing stuff. But marrying the two together, we haven't tried to do yet.
That is a question from Stephen Park on Zoom.
Okay, I know Steve.
Obvious question. What about leptons?
Oh,
That was.
okay. So I think I've already pre-answered that.
Yeah. I'm not sure if he wants to make another comment. Yes.
So I've got a question. It's more my understanding then. In that emission instrument that you got, you explain correctly that the masses run, and but yet there's also the explanation that the masses are related to the size of the unitary triangle.
Yes.
But the area of the unitary triangle is invariant. So I don't understand. There seems to be some conflict that, well,
Okay, that's
my
a very
perception
perceptive
is.
question.
Right.
So the shape of the Unitarian triangle is invariant. So the so these, the 90-degree angle, the angles in the corners don't run. But the standard unitary triangle, that's the what I call the unnormalized one, the one you get if you just dot the rows of the CK matrix and you don't normalize, so the base is one. That the sides of that matrix are all scaled by VCB, and VCB does run with energy. So that the unitary triangle as a whole does run with energy scale. It's just the shape doesn't run. So it evolves, it gets bigger and smaller. As you well, it gets bigger as you go towards the gut scale.
Does that imply CP violation then? Also,
the amount of CP violation runs. So A, which is VCB is A lambda squared. So A runs from 13% from the weak to the gut scale, and so. Also, therefore, does the unitary triangle, which hopefully I find the right slide. Actually, it was a bit of that work. So this is the scaled unitary triangle, but the normal unitary triangle has just got VUB here and VTD here times things that are essentially unity. And VUB is A lambda cubed times rho plus I eta or something. And so that's got A in it, and A scales, A runs with energy. So actually the area runs as A squared.
CP violation.
So CP violation should be sort of 26% more at that scale than it is at the weak scale on the area of the unitary triangle. But it runs in such a way that these angles are essentially invariant, I presume.
Actually, another one related to the one I asked before called. So I think if I try and say what I think you said, which was that the Fritsch was basically born of it being part of maybe some other theories that are in some ways natural, right?
That, mm-hmm.
Whereas your approach is born of wanting to make the numbers work.
Yes,
better.
It's so more
it's sort of built
heuristic.
The other way up.
Yes,
yeah. But
we don't have a model for this apart from the symmetries.
Okay, yeah. So
I've talked to Steve King and
yeah,
it's not to do with it.
Okay, so there's not the opposite thing, which is to then say which are the theories that it fits into. You don't have that yet.
Not yet. No,
do you have a feel for anything that might relate to it?
That's a nice question.
It's a very open question. I mean, I know it's just a
not off the top of my head. I mean, I think if I was going to start building a model, I would try and incorporate Froggatt-Nielsen.
Mm-hmm.
So Froggatt-Nielsen, they have some heavy, very super heavy bosons, and then the fermions coupled to these super heavy bosons, like the Higgs mechanism, well, like that with Yukawa couplings, and they can couple more than once. So you can have a fermion and the boson, then the fermion, then another boson, and the number of times they're coupled to that boson is proportional to the powers of these small parameters in the mass matrix, and it all works rather nicely. And I talked to Steve, and I went to Southampton for the day, and we had a nice day and chatted about this, but we couldn't immediately see a way to actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sort of a bit stuck at the moment.
But it works that way up. So yeah.
You would use this to try and say, what kind of model has these discrete symmetries as well? The discrete symmetries of this, negating the sign of the size of the unitary triangle and that corresponding to CP symmetry. It's a bit wicked. It's a bit unusual, and no one's sort of come up with anything as yet. So maybe it's just accident.
Well, and on that point, I mean, are there other places where it could be applicable? You mentioned the leptons and that. So is it that is there any indication that this approach might be something more universal in other sectors?
We've only got two examples of fermion mixing, of course. We've got the quarks and the leptons, and they're very different.
Yeah.
I mean, completely outside our stuff, there's this idea of quark-lepton complementarity, where the deviations of the CK matrix from just the identity, all being small, correspond to the deviations of the lepton mixing from tri-bimaximal. And then tri-bimaximal would be somehow introduced sort of leptons by the seesaw mechanism, and that would be the bimaximal bit, and then a small perturbation of that would be both on the lepton side and the quark side, and they'd be related to each other somehow. So you'd have approximate tri-bimaximal and approximate identity for mixing. And there are models that do that, which are very, very interesting, very intriguing. So, I mean, it would be nice to try and build something like that in, onto this, or vice versa, build this onto that. Then time's finite.
Yeah, and I mean, it's only two sectors, only two real sectors. And now, it's crazy the other sector that was in the back of my mind was a Higgs sector. Of course, you don't have mixing in the same way, but just whether there are
not in the same way.
Extension.
I mean, ultimately, it's all in the standard model. It's all your power couplings.
Exactly. Yeah.
Plus, the seesaw mechanism for the neutrinos, which we can reasonably confidently expect. I'm not working on this at the moment. Just finished an Atlas paper, so the VCD measurement.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah, great to see.
Okay.
Maybe a question from Zoom. Is anything here on an explanation of why there are three generations? Or
no.
Could it still work if there were four?
I would think it. The nice parts of this would almost certainly break down with four generations, but I haven't thought about it in detail. Three generations is very special for CP violation. This thing that the unitary triangle area is the same for all triangles, that's no longer true with four generations. So the whole unitarity triangle idea breaks down. We end up with the unitarity polygon, well, the unitarity quadrilateral with four generations, and lots of the really neat stuff. The three generations really is special in the world of CP violation. And there are other things, aren't there, in theory, where triangle anomalies cancel with three families or something. I don't know much about that. It's gauge theory stuff, but. I mean, I think four generations are. There are lots of things that discourage us from believing that four generations are true. The width of the Z and things like that. But of course, you can never say never. But if there's a fourth generation, the extra quarks aren't like the other quarks. They're not like the quarks we know about. It would be very unnatural, I think, at this point.
Any more questions here?
Oh, and I just want to say, I love visiting. It's always lovely to be here. It's nice to see so many old friends and faces that you haven't seen for a long time.
Yes.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that's a good transition to our lunch. So if you would like to join, I hope you get
I'll
some
have to
time.
Very, very quick.
A very quick lunch with Paul. Yeah. Well, yes, you're welcome. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.